from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, when physician Daphne Miller visited farms across the country, she wondered how she could relate farming to treating her patients. In her new book, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing, Daphne Miller shares her experiences at seven family farms and suggests that if people treated their bodies the way farmers treat soil, we would be a lot healthier and happier. She joins us for the hour to discuss ecological farm habits and their relation to healthy living. That's after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Bay Area medical doctor Daphne Miller joins us in studio for this Forum hour to discuss the connection between farming and human health and healing. A physician, as well as an author and professor of family medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, she is as well a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. We discussed her first book with her on Forum, The Jungle Effect, The Healthiest Diets from Around the World, Why They Work and How to Make Them Work for You. Her newest book is called Pharmacology, that's F-A-R-M, What Innovative Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. And we welcome Dr. Daphne Miller to the second hour Forum. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to have you. And let's begin by saying that you went to family farms, innovative family farms, sort of as a research project, as an empirical project. What spurred you to do that?
Well, it was an odyssey. Rather, I think it would probably be better for me to describe it as an exploration that started actually on the farm of Wendell Berry.
In Kentucky.
He's that amazing writer, philosopher, farmer, activist. And I went there because I actually had been reading his book, The Unsettling of America. And there was one particular chapter called The Body and the Earth that really caught my attention. He was writing about us being these moving particles of Earth. And he said that given how closely we resemble the soil, that it would make sense that the way we treat our bodies is indeed the way we treat the soil. And the way we care for our bodies should match the way we care for the soil. And this and a number of other readings that I was starting to do on agriculture moved my brain from nutrition above the ground, so the foods that were actually, you know, being grown, to really thinking about farms, the places where these foods were being grown, and realizing that I needed to start to learn from farmers because they were on the forefront of healing all of us and taking care of all of us. So I made my way to Kentucky and had a conversation with Wendell Berry, which is really what started me on this trip.
Well, actually, before you even went to Kentucky, you write about your own, you use the word germination, and you say it may have even been prenatal because your parents were farmers before you were born, and then they actually went and bought themselves a rotten old farm, as you describe it. Plus, you're on a kibbutz in Israel. Yeah,
that is all correct. The only part that might not be quite correct is to call my parents farmers. They were homesteaders and were trying to farm, for sure, but were never quite made a success of it. Turns out it's really hard to be a good farmer.
Especially these days with agribusiness and with farming not necessarily having the advantages that it had in a whole different ethos for American values and American culture. I mean, things have changed radically. And the family farms, they have a lot of challenges. I'm putting it mildly, I think, here when I say that, as I'm sure you're well aware. But I want to get back to your own experiences because you write early on about, and this had something to do with maybe shaping you into a doctor, too, about the beheading of a lamb.
Yes, early on, I when I was very young and we were living on this farm in upstate New York, I write about walking out to a field near our farmhouse and finding my pet lamb tragically missing its head. And in that moment, I remember both being just devastated and crying in my father's arms and hiding my head. And at the same time, one eye kind of peeking out to check out the horror. And I write about this as sort of being that early awareness of the division in me between, you know, being interested, so interested in biology and the natural world and also terrified of it. Yeah.
And your parents' experience with homesteading was sort of a failure in many ways, wasn't it?
Well, my parents are brilliant folks, and they're both professors and very successful in that realm. But the truth is that they didn't quite make it as farmers, yes.
So in going to see Wendell Berry, and Wendell Berry's been on the show a couple times, in fact, going to see his farm and these other farms, you were seeing farmers, for the most part, who have had success, as well as farmers who were in some ways embodying what you were looking for, the spirit of what you were looking for, that is the connection between the soil and the land and growing things and our own health.
Yes, and my parents, their teachers, to be fair, were farmers in that valley who were doing what I call chemical farming, which is very much what everybody was, or most people were doing in the 70s and 60s, which is really using a lot of pesticides and herbicides and nitrogen fertilizer. And the farmers who I went and started to learn from as I made this journey were farmers who were using biological farming, who were very interested in the regenerative forces of nature and recycling things back into the soil and creating these intricate webs of life in order to grow fruits and vegetables. And that was the model that really intrigued me, because it's this complexity model that I wanted to bring to my own medical practice and to my patients.
You also talk about the darker side of farming with the pesticides and the poisoning and even this, you talk about the smell of soil drenched in chemicals. So it's I presume when I read this that you had some very strong political views that were confirmed.
Well, I don't know if I would say they're political views. They're more biological views. And for me, my real awakening in terms of being interested in ecological farming had to do with actually starting to read the biochemistry and the science of soil. So that now literally I'm a family doctor who kind of has my brain in the soil. But it was really when I started to understand what a natural carbon cycle is supposed to be and how plants use photosynthesis to grab carbon from the air and then feed that carbon down to the plants and fungi, to the microbes and fungi in the soil in the form of nutrients for them, and how then those fungi digest the plants and feed them back up to the top of the soil, so that carbon is in this constant cycle. And when you start to recognize the natural carbon cycle and how much we've moved away from it through chemical farming, through using fertilizers and pesticides, then you understand how depleted we all are, because it's really in maintaining that natural cycle that we can get all the nutrients we need to be healthy.
I certainly respect not only your view as a scientist and a physician, a family physician, but the idea of how we treat the soil is how we should treat ourselves does have political implications to it. I mean, the idea of pesticides and these sorts of things used by agribusiness to a large extent traditionally and everything gets us into that realm of how we poison ourselves, or how food poisons us, or how the things we should eat as opposed to things we don't eat, and how we treat our bodies. I mean, it's maybe I'm a kid of the 60s, but it's political as well as personal.
It is political in the sense that we have legislation that enables agribusiness to build, you know, to produce these chemicals and doesn't support the other industry. But the basis for my thinking is very much more within health and science and not so much guided by that.
Well, we return to the soil. We are the soil. I mean, it's almost biblical when we think about humanity and the connection to the soil and all this almost sacred notion of the earth and how the earth reflects us and so forth. And in many ways, you know, I associate somebody like Wendell Berry with that ethos. It's a very important ethos, and you certainly bring it out in your book. But you also bring out some some pretty engaging stories about medical ecology or about sustainable agriculture or about health and medicine. I want to at least give listeners a flavor of some of those stories. Well, before we get into stories specifically, let's talk about your friend Grant Colfax, who I guess now is also a practicing physician and has worked with goats, who you write about. In some ways, I found myself thinking in reading about him and your thoughts about him, and it's all part of your odyssey, what you described as your odyssey, that you were taking a little bit of a critical view of the training you both had at Harvard in medical school. You call it reductionist training. You know, diagnose and conquer, in fact, is what you say. So maybe political in the sense of medical education not coming up to what it should be doing?
Well, I certainly think that there's a huge emphasis in the American training on...
I'm not trying to make you politicize you.
No. That's fine. But I certainly think in our training, the emphasis is on reductionist thinking and on finding that silver bullet, that perfect cure that will match each disease. And, you know, we could spend hours discussing the roots of this, but the truth is that that kind of thinking is very comforting because it means that, you know, for every problem, there is a solution. But, you know, the things that are in the two, many problems inherent in that. But one is that for most of what ails us today in our modern culture here in the United States, the diabetes, the heart disease, the depression, we know now that there is no silver bullet, that these are complex diseases that have many, many causes that are all interrelated, social, ecological, financial, biological, genetic. And so we need a much more complex way of approaching them, what I call the complexity approach. And this is something that ecological farmers have long recognized in terms of growing beautiful, nutrient-dense food, that they can't use a silver bullet and that they have to be complex in their approach. So for me, going out and learning for these farmers really was adopting this paradigm as well, not only gaining these important farm-to-body lessons about how important healthy soil is for our physical health, but really changing my mindset, the way that I approach problem-solving within my own discipline.
Talking to Dr. Daphne Miller, and her new book is Pharmacology, that's F-A-R-M, What Innovative Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. Let's talk about some of your experiences then, and maybe I'll begin close to home here with pest management up in a winery in Napa. Someone would think pest management and treatment of cancer, but you found something there.
Well, first of all, I have to say, for the winery's sake, it's in Sonoma. It's a wonderful little winery called Scribe. And that whole chapter for me was really a lesson on reapproaching cancer from a very different vantage point. And in traditional agriculture, there's very much a warrior approach to pests. The idea is that you burn it out, you know, use whatever poison you have at your disposal to get rid of pests, and at any cost, really. And what's interesting is if you look in medicine, cancer is sort of the pest equivalent, and we have very much that same attitude that, you know, burn it out, nuke it out, cut it out, poison it out. And statistically, if you start to look at the inroads that we've made with cancer treatment in the past 50 years, it's pretty dismal, especially for invasive cancers, cancers that have moved beyond just a very limited area. For most cancers, if anything, the death rate has started to go up a little bit. And so looking now to a vineyard like Scribe, they've moved away from that standard warrior approach and have moved to something that's called integrated pest management, or IPM, which I would call a much more enlightened way of dealing with pests. And in IPM, the idea really is to think of pests more as part of the natural ecology, that they aren't the enemy at all costs. And when you do this, there's two things that start to happen. First of all, you don't make mistakes. For example, there are times where you think of something as just a, you know, in complete black and white, as just a pest, and it turns out that it actually has a beneficial role within that ecology. The great example that the vintner gave me was that when he first started to work on Scribe and to grow his vines, he saw rattlesnakes were everywhere. And he decided there was no good use for a rattlesnake, so he started to kill them all. And next thing you know, his vines started to disappear underground. Mm. And that was because the rattlesnakes were actually eating the voles, the little rodents. And the minute they disappeared, the rodents came out and started to destroy the vines. The second idea behind IPM is that if you take this warrior approach and just obliterate at any cost, then what gets left behind are the really hardy ones. And they are the ones that end up coming back en force and really taking over, and are the ones that are resistant to whatever pesticide you're using. Now, it turns out in cancer, these two same concepts apply, that sometimes cells that we think of as the evil cells might not actually end up being so evil. And that also when we take the warrior approach, those are the stories where you hear someone's fine and then 5 years later or 10 years later, the cancer comes back very, very aggressively. So in Scribe, they started to really develop an ecological model where they were supporting all the beneficials, all the good things in the field, and trying to keep the whole ecology in balance rather than just blasting out the pests. And it turns out that there are oncologists who are doing the same thing, who are starting to look at the integrated pest management model and trying to do that within our bodies with cancer and support the healthy cells.
It's right in the vanguard of oncological research, really, isn't it?
Yes, it's amazing stuff they're doing. And it still is quite novel for some people within biomedicine. And it's certainly a different mindset when it comes to cancer, not to think of it as that it's just out and out evil that needs to be destroyed, but maybe a pest within the larger field of our cells that just needs to be managed.
Again, we're talking with Daphne Miller about her new book. It's all about medical ecology and sustainable agriculture and innovative agriculture and health. And a lot of epiphanies came through these seven visits that you made. Let's talk about the chicken farm in Arkansas, because, again, the epiphany was nobody would make this connection necessarily on the face of things, a chicken farm and stress or positive stress management, but that's what you found.
Oh, that chapter offered me more lessons on stress than I ever received in medical school. And it's an important thing for a doctor to know about, since it's probably the number one problem that walks through my office every day. But that was essentially two farms in one. It was an egg farm in Arkansas. And on one side of the road, you had just your typical hellish egg farm, the kind that you see in when activists, animal activists, post pictures online of the inside of a hen house with 15,000 hens shoved into a concrete coop. And their tips of their beaks removed and dust and feathers flying everywhere. And by the way, those hens that I visited on the first farm, or the first segment of the farm, were free-range organic. They're the free-range organic ones you buy in the supermarket. Organic being because they are fed organic mash, and free-range because they have a little alley, a strip of dirt outside the hen house that they're allowed to run on. But then across the road from this hellish farm was a pastured facility. And it was the same farmer who owned the two. And for both economic and ethical reasons, he was converting his farm over to the pastured farm. So it was really this interesting natural experiment. And across the road, the chickens were, you know, out in sunshine. They had plenty of room to move. They had an acre of grass that they could peck on. You could tell that they were forming social networks. They were dust bathing. They were singing.
Were they tweeting? Were they doing Facebook?
They were tweeting. They were so happy. To me, it looked like chicken nirvana. And so I commented to the egg farmer. I said, wow, those hens over across the road must be just stressed to death, whereas these guys must just have a stress-free existence. That must be why they're so healthy. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, that's actually not quite true. These hens, these pastured hens, have
plenty of stress. They just have a different kind of stress. I mean, they can get attacked by a hawk. They can get pelted in a thunderstorm. They could fall off a roost because they actually can move around. They could peck each other because they have the tips of their beaks are still intact. Said, but, you know, I think this is a good kind of stress because they make healthier eggs. So in each chapter, I don't just speak to the farmers. I actually go speak to biomedical researchers who are, you know, doing the science behind this. And in this case, I went to Rockefeller University and spent time with a scientist named Bruce McEwen, who is really one of the grandfathers of modern stress research. And Bruce has actually done research in both chicken stress and human stress, so he turned out to be a great person for me to visit. And he said, yes, it's true they both have stress, but in fact, the hens in the pastured facility both have the resources to deal with stress. In fact, they're stress-proofed because they're making social networks and they have tons of choice in their day. And those are two things that we know create stress resilience. And also the kind of stress they're getting, even if it's really high drama at times, and maybe even if it's really almost deadly, they can manage it because it's episodic and then they go back to their daily wonderful life versus the ones across the road who never have high drama stress but are constantly sort of in this low-grade awfulness. And even the smallest thing will tip them over the edge into disease. And it turns out that it's the exact same for us as humans, that, you know, being in a windowless office with a boss that nags at you and not getting time to exercise, that's like being in the first facility. And in the second facility, even if you're occasionally called on the radio to speak to Michael Krasny or, you know, have these other things that get your heart pumping, if in the background you actually have a pretty, you know, good social networks and lots of choice, then you can manage it. And this has really changed the way I deal with my patients. I think a lot more about stress-proofing them and not getting stress out of their life.
I want to get one more in here because we're coming up on a break, and that is lots of people who listen to this program are concerned about raising children, and you learned something there, too, in your forays to different family farms. I'd just like you to kind of give us a sense of what that experience was and how the biomedicine backed it up.
Yes, yeah, so this was
grazing, basically.
Yes, it's grazing. But this gets back to the soil again. This is a rancher in Missouri in the Ozarks who calls himself a holistic rancher. But there was a time when he raised his cows very conventionally and put all the hormones and antibiotics into them and used lots of inputs into his field and used supplements on his calves. And he realized, once again, for ethical and financial reasons, he was actually losing money, that he needed to stop doing all of that. And it created a real domino effect on his farm where he had to start farming in a completely different way. He couldn't let his cows graze willy-nilly on his pastures because he actually needed to allow time for the pasture to replenish. And so he started to graze them in this system called mob grazing or holistic grazing, where they would just all 1,000 head of cattle crunched into, you know, 7-acre paddocks. And then he'd move them so they would take a whole year for them to come back. And as he started to do this, he realized that everything was improving on his land, the health of the soil, the health of his prairie, and most importantly, the health of his calves. He wasn't seeing any of the chronic diseases and respiratory diseases that he'd been seeing before. And he explained to me that the reason for this was that his soil had actually inoculated his calves. And it turns out when I talked to researchers that this was indeed the case.
Well, I'm going to open our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join this conversation, talking really about the soil and health and agriculture and how they are connected with Dr. Daphne Miller. You can join us. In fact, we invite you to do that now. Toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When physician Daphne Miller visited farms across the country, she wondered how she could relate farming to treating her patients. In her new book, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing, she shares her experiences at 7 family farms and suggests that if people treated their bodies the way farmers treat soil, we'd be a lot healthier and happier. She's with us in studio this hour talking about ecological farm habits and their relation to healthy living. And you may indeed have something to contribute to this conversation, some thoughts about our relationship to the soil and what we do to grow our food and what we do to ourselves in terms of not only consuming food, but taking in perhaps what the soil takes in and how it affects us. Your calls and your emails are welcome. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. And we also welcome any stories you might have along the lines of what we're talking about. That is where you might have seen connections between farming, agriculture, maybe even just out in the farms that you go to that are out in almost every suburb now, selling organic food and the like, and the way we treat our bodies, or the way we can perhaps better treat our bodies and preventive health, not even to mention health treatment or medical treatment. Again, your calls and emails are welcome. You can also join us by going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. I'm looking at something called Daphne's Soothing Herbal Tea Organic, which she brought in and gave to me. I thought it was maybe cannabis at first, I must confess, because it looks a little like one of those sorts of plants. But let's just talk about what we take into our bodies from, say, I mean, you've done work with Andy Weil, and you understand a lot about the herbal side of this equation. How much does that play into what we grow as opposed to what's inside of us and our health?
Well, in terms of thinking of food as medicine, which is really now a line that's been so overused that we've almost forgotten exactly what we're saying, it's critically important. I mean, it is the medicine that we put in our bodies pretty willingly, at least 3 times a day. And so every physician and every health provider needs to become fluent in issues around food and whole foods and nutrition if they want to really take care of patients. But I think that, telling patients to eat their fruits and vegetables, which is something I've done for years, is really only part of the story. And as I've started to spend time on farms and learning from farmers and also learning from scientists who are making the bridge between agriculture and health, I realize how critically important it is for all of us to pay attention to really how those fruits and vegetables are coming into being, and that an apple is not an apple is not an apple, and all the choices that are made on the farm from the seed that's used or the way that we treat the soil or the systems of agriculture that are used or the way that we harvest have everything to do with the nutrients that make it into our bodies. And it's amazing to me how many things that in medicine we're trying to solve with technology and pills without ever asking whether there might be a simpler way. I mean, a great example that I was reading about the other day is that trace mineral manganese, which finding really plays a role in infertility, lack of manganese, in terms of sperm motility and even in terms of egg growth. And that rang a bell with me because speaking with farmers, manganese is one of those minerals that quickly disappears from mistreated soil. And yet it's not something that in conventional agriculture is even added to the soil. You know, they really focus on nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And yet here is this trace mineral that we know makes a difference in human health. And how many couples are, mortgaging their health and mortgaging their homes to have a child. And I'm not saying that rebuilding manganese in the soil is going to solve the infertility problem. But why aren't we even looking at those simple
issues?
I
mentioned when you came in and handed me this herbal, soothing herbal tea, raspberry tea leaves, which were a friend of mine wanted to get pregnant with his girlfriend many years ago when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and sent for a large batch of raspberry tea leaves, which supposedly enhanced fertility. And the gendarmes came into the picture. They thought he was, receiving cannabis or something like that through the mail. But this is all tied together. This is a kind of ecological view and of ecosystems and how the ecosystems in the soil are very much like the ecosystems in our body. And we need to understand like you say, health providers, doctors need to understand that connectedness. I actually get some responses from listeners here and go to our calls. But first, here's an email from Will who writes, Kierkegaard wrote about the concept of crop rotation and its benefits to our mental health. It's a fascinating analogy for human psychology. Have you connected with this concept at all when it comes to medicine?
Absolutely. And for me, all of what I'm writing about in this book and really where my mind is these days is exactly what this listener wrote about, is the idea of biodiversity, the idea that the real path to health is not going to be through one solution or one type of seed or one way to treat our bodies or our soil, but really that we need to foster a huge amount of diversity in terms of microbes in the soil, and now we're learning in terms of microbes in our gut, in terms of the kinds of nutrients we take in, the kinds of foods we eat, and also in our behavioral patterns, our sleep patterns. This idea of biodiversity, it's a word that's never used in human health.
It's a word that came to
health.
Us from E.O. Wilson.
Exactly.
A lot of people don't recognize that he actually gave us that word.
Exactly, and it's used all the time by ecologists, and yet it's never used in human health. And it has everything to do with our physical health as well. In fact, there is an amazing article that just got published in the journal, the World Allergy Journal, that shows how as biodiversity on this planet has started to really, really disappear in the past 20 to 30 years, our allergic diseases have increased in perfect lockstep. So it's like these two graphs that are in mirror image. And the reason they publish this is because we know that allergy is sort of an inappropriate immune response. And it really comes from not being exposed to a whole variety of organisms early on in our lives, maybe even early on as in utero, so that we develop a smart immune system, an appropriate immune system.
Immune system is like, again, ecology. I mean, in terms of everything that's put into it and all of the interaction and synchronicity between all of those things. Here's a very practical question, actually kind of a couple of questions from Doug and Pinole, and we'll go to your calls in just a moment. But he writes, what are the economics of this? Does it make sense for a farmer to pursue a method of agriculture that embraces this sort of belief in holistic or non-reductionist method of farming? Any studies on the improvement of health of the consumers of food that is grown using this method?
Yes and yes to all of that. I wish I had Cody Holmes here in the room. He's that rancher in Missouri who was going broke using input method farming, or what he would call chemical farming. And Cody claims that other than moving his 1,000 head of cattle from paddock to paddock, which takes him about 10 minutes a day, he can spend most of his time on Facebook now educating other farmers. He virtually does nothing in his 1,000 acres in Missouri because the cows are doing it all. They are eating the grass and then refertilizing the grass with what they are taking in and building up all those trillions of unpaid workers who are in the soil, the microbiota, who are really doing the work. And I don't want to share Cody's annual income on the radio because that's just impolite. But let me tell you that
the IRS may be listening.
Right, he makes more than I do as a family doctor, and he was actually taking loans from the bank before he converted to this method. That hen farmer that I talked to you about in Arkansas, I mean, this guy wears a suit and tie to his hen house every day. He's a businessman. And, you know, he lives on his land and he's a wonderful guy, but he's a businessman. And he's converting over to this pasture-based model because he realized that each egg has 4 to 8 times the amount of nutrients as it did in the old conventional model, or even in the free-range organic model. And that he can charge twice as much per egg because you're actually getting quadruple the bang for your buck per egg. So it's making good economic sense.
Let's go to our callers. And we begin, Gregory, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been very intrigued by what Dr. Miller has to say. I'm in the ag industry. And in talking with growers, we will very often point out the correlation between their plant health and human health. And you know, as a human, we wouldn't want to eat just one particular type of food and have the input of only one type of nutrient, but rather we have a well-balanced diet and we're getting all these nutrients. Not only is the plant health better, but also eventually human health and animal health is going to be better because we're consuming plants and food that organized again.
He's talking your language, isn't he, Daphne?
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, it's funny how these epiphanies come. And I'm really embarrassed, I have to tell you, because I really spent over a decade writing about food and nutrition without really having my brain move into the soil. And it was a slow progression. And I think a lot of farmers think that I'm probably a little slow on the uptake, but they understand the model which I was coming from. But for me, one of the another moment of epiphany was sitting there with right after I'd spent time with an ecological farmer who was talking to me about all the nutrients that the bacteria are actually helping him harvest from the soil, and looking at a vitamin bottle that a patient had brought in. And, you know, the patient had dutifully brought in their vitamins to say, are these okay for me to take? And as I was looking at the list, it's pretty much everything that that farmer's bacteria are helping them harvest from the soil. And I sat there and I was thinking, well, you know, wouldn't it be better for you to just eat the plants that, you know, Eric is growing, farmers growing, rather than taking these supplements that are, if anything, you know, only doing second best and maybe doing nothing at all?
I don't know if you remember, but back a while, there were people who were arguing that plants responded to singing and to tender voice messages, and they were actually trying to prove this. It's a very difficult thing to prove, obviously. But the fact of the matter is that when we talk about nurturing, for example, our children or nurturing ourselves, we think about good nutrition. We think about all the things, biodiversity, all the things you're talking about, but also a kind of balance, really, that one needs to strike. I mean, I don't suggest necessarily talking to plants, but you have to make sure.
No, you should talk to plants.
Well, you got to nurture them, right?
Yeah,
just like you have to nurture yourself. And
yeah,
your
in some form or another, we all should be talking to plants. And I realize this is where I start to really lose scientific credibility with your listeners. But, you know, E.O. Wilson, once again, coined the term biophilia, you know, this idea of loving, of this idea that being close to greenery and so on is truly what amplifies us, what makes our hearts sing as humans. But it turns out I actually, in the last chapter of the book, I spend time with an aromatic herb farmer who was in a Washington state, and she was kind of a green witch. She was part chemist, part metaphysical thinker. And she, in my conversations with her, I realized that the same pathway in plants, which is the mevalonic pathway, which creates their secondary metabolites, their tannins, all the things that make plants smell good, like geraniol, and, you know, the things that make you want to sniff a rose. All of those, that same pathway exists in all of us and is really the critical pathway that helps us make cholesterol, helps us make sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen. It's also what helps us make our pheromones. And it makes sense because, you know, in the primordial ooze, we all emerge from the same unicellular organisms. And it turns out that this olfactory ability, this mevalonic pathway, was really how we all communicated. So if you think about it, since we're using the same system of communication, we are still communicating with plants. I mean, it might be right now that you're turning on some plant somewhere, Michael.
Talk to your plants. Speak to your ferns lovingly. If biophilia makes your heart sing, so be it. Your heart beating faster just coming on the radio. Let me, as you alluded to before, let me get another caller on. Hugh, that's you. Hi.
I don't know if it's generational to think that some of this is more political, but I have...
Hugh, we're having problems hearing you. Go ahead. I think your phone may be tapping out on us, but go ahead.
Sorry. Let me see if you can hear better there. So I don't know if it's generational, but I have some friends who are about a decade older, much more liberal than I am, who kind of view many herbicides and pesticides as if they're illegal, then they must be healthy. Otherwise, the government, you know, wouldn't allow them. But as an example to why I pay attention to it and our family does, was a program on KQED or a news on KQED a couple of years ago about how the state of California had had to change some of the water mains coming through the farm country early because the pesticides had eroded the metal. And, you know, secondarily, there's a fiscal concern there as well, but it just shocked me that, you know, that if it's eroding metal, what's it doing to our bodies?
So I absolutely agree with this caller that there might actually be a very different mindset in terms of thinking of ecological farming in amongst younger people, and that it isn't a right, you know, a right wing or left wing issue. It really is a health issue. And once again, Cody Holmes, that farmer in Missouri, I think in terms of politics and who we voted for in the last election, we probably are sort of diametrically opposed. But for Cody, it's very much like this gentleman was describing, that he was just seeing the facts in front of him, and he was seeing these cows in which he was dumping all of these external inputs into them, and yet they were getting diseases, you know, right and left, and this huge amount of calf death happening on this farm. That's a hard one to say, calf death. And what he started to realize was that he was, every season when it came time to inject his cattle with the hormones and the antibiotics, he was keeping out one or two cows, and those were the ones that he was feeding to his own children. Mm-hmm. And the hypocrisy was getting to him. And so that was another thing that motivated him to change. And so absolutely, these issues are not political issues. They become political when, obviously, when there's a financial interest and one side or the other is supporting the agribusiness industry, the chemical industry. But these are health issues. And until farmers actually start to speak with doctors and we have a real exchange and understand how much we are doing the same work, and until doctors have classes in medical school where they learn about the soil, then we're not going to be able to translate that into the general, you know, public. In fact, I would say that the general public is much more knowledgeable than most doctors when it comes to soil health.
So. Well, let me thank you for the call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But speaking of the general public, I'm looking at an email here, and you were speaking of cows. Carolyn says, what does mad cow disease contribute to your hypothesis?
Well, mad cow disease is, for me, just another example of sort of the hubris of technology, this idea that some, you know, that was developed of, you know what, in cow feed or in animal feed, I have a great idea. Let's just, you know, grind up other animals, their brains and their hearts and so on, and feed it on to the next generation. And that, you know, that's a great source of protein. Well, it turns out that cows are not carnivores. You know, if you leave a cow to its own devices, it's not going to go eat another cow. And so, you know, once again, that's bucking the natural model of things.
Don't prions play a role in mad cow disease?
Yes, absolutely. But prions are part, they exist within the dead matter of the living tissue. You don't get prions from eating corn or grass or what have you. And I want to emphasize something, Michael, because I think it's important. Your listeners might be left with the impression that with everything I'm saying that I'm anti-technology. And that's not at all the case. I actually believe very much in biomedical science and just the way that I actually believe in agricultural science. But I believe that it needs to be used to actually enhance natural models, natural systems that exist. I mean, a great example, once again, is Cody, the farmer, who's using a really sophisticated kind of fencing system to imitate the way that bison used to graze 200 years ago in the plains and with his cattle. So, you know, using technology in that way, in the same way as I worked with biomedical researchers who are really trying to understand what the soil is giving farm children in terms of immunity, and seeing if that's something that they could capture for urban dwellers as well, you know, through different kinds of exposures. But it's once again looking at a natural model that's out there rather than trying to one-up nature.
Our guest is Dr. Daphne Miller. Her new book is Pharmacology: What Innovative Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. And we're going to go to another caller. And Rebecca, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think this is very important information, and you haven't lost any credibility with this listener.
You're talking to your plants, Rebecca?
Well, I guess they get to listen to NPR quite a bit.
That's good. It's good nutrition.
Yeah. I was wondering if your guest had heard of Wes Jackson in the town they call Salina in Kansas, and he does a lot of work with no-till, so you're saving the topsoil, the precious topsoil, and multi-cropping kinds of things, like you would harvest a granola, so it's kind of fitting into the complexity of agriculture to heal us, maybe.
I think Dr. Miller is quite familiar.
I'm nodding over here. Yes, the Land Institute. Wes Jackson's actually very close friends with Wendell Berry. They do a lot of work together. And what Wes Jackson is doing is something that enlightened farmers and farm researchers around the globe are doing, and that is that they're sitting back and they're actually looking at how nature farms. What's the farming system that you see in place when you walk into an untouched thicket in the woods or a prairie? How is the soil maintained there? How are the plants grown? How are things regenerated? And it turns out that when nature farms, she does what you describe Wes Jackson is doing. She always keeps the ground covered. She conserves water. She farms mostly with perennials and uses indigenous or local seeds that actually work in that environment. Another very important thing that nature does that Wes Jackson is very aware of is that nature farms with animals. Animals always play a role in any kind of healthy, regenerative agricultural system. And so it's really looking at these natural models that farmers are developing ideas through, you know, like permaculture and all these eco models for farming, biodynamics. I mean, these are, you know, they all have their specific system to them. But in truth, what they're all doing, what they all have in common is that they're farming in the image of nature.
Listener writes, for generations, veterinarians have understood the medical connections between stress, nutrition, environment, and health, often counseling farmers regarding husbandry. It's amazing how naively the medical establishment has evolved and is now starting to get it, rather than making it up as they go. Maybe more collaborations are in order.
Oh, yes. We've all been so balkanized, and I wish I could just point to, you know, my colleagues in medicine, but I feel like it happens a lot in all the sciences. And there are very few scientists within each realm who are, you know, willing to bridge these divides. I feel like it is starting to happen more and more. And there's actually a movement afoot. They even have a website, and it's called One Health. And I do believe that you had Barbara Natterson Horowitz on the on the program. She wrote a wonderful book called Zubiquity about species-spanning health. And this
she was co-authored, I think.
Excuse me. But this is a very, very important idea that our health is intimately connected to the health of animals and plants and so on. And in truth, we're all going to only get healthier and get better if we connect and support each other. We can't do it on the shoulders of one another.
What a good positive note to end on. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Daphne Miller, again, is the author of Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. Good to have you on. And it's time now for our occasional mailbag segment, when we devote a few minutes to read from your emails and comments. First up is a note from Sage, who wants to see more class diversity represented on our shows, and specifically our show on invisible physical disability. She wrote, and I'm quoting, I have listened to a few programs on KQED, most recently the fascinating interviews concerning invisible illnesses. I have noticed before the lack of voices of those in the so-called underclass. It really hit home in this program, as I have had chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome and spinal stenosis for 20 years plus. And Sage went on to say, the interviews were wonderful, but saddened me as well, as I felt very alienated. It would be good to hear from some poor people dealing with these life-altering issues. And author Gary Camilla joined us in a discussion of San Francisco history and quintessential spots. And Charles shared this story during that show. When I was previously fighting depression in San Francisco, a friend invited me to join her morning walking routine, which later became a morning walk up Twin Peaks. Every morning when I got to the top of Twin Peaks, I would say, no matter how bad you feel, when you start the walk, It is impossible not to feel better when looking out from Twin Peaks for the 360-degree view. Thank you, San Francisco. But Christopher wrote in with this comment, "It was in some ways a fun show, but my main frustration is that it was almost completely devoid of discussion about how the city's diversity and culture is being ravaged by displacement and gentrification. I was on the line most of the show waiting to say that what's beautiful about the city, beyond the striking landscapes, is the people, not only artists and writers and musicians, but different Latino and Asian American cultures, much of it now embattled and under siege from gentrification. I waited online as caller after caller shared their favorite spots and never got on despite having something different to offer." And lastly, yesterday we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington by hearing from people who participated, and Mary sent this note in. "I'm thrilled that your guests have brought up the labor component of the march, a historical strand that's easy to lose in today's anti-union atmosphere. The little white kid who my grandson is named Asa in honor of, and in hopes that he will follow the path of Asa Philip Randolph, the great union organizer and visionary of the march. May I suggest that people of any ethnicity who are expecting or adopting a baby name that newborn after someone on the march. This would personalize that moment in history when Americans decided we may not be able to achieve Martin Luther King's dream in every way we want, but we'll never go back to what was before. Thank you again for the continued feedback, responses, and stories, which we do every other Thursday. These shows and all of our shows are archived online at kqed.org/forum, and you can always send us an email at forum@kqed.org. And I want to also invite listeners at this point to share any apology stories that you might have or questions about apologies for Facebook. Dave Iverson will be discussing the art of the apology tomorrow on Forum. And if all goes according to plan, I will be back with you on Monday. I thank you for your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Katie Springer. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks and Chad McClymans. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Evelyn Wang, Nick Zabrowski, and Angela Johnston. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.